Okay. We take a break now for the panel. So Jack and Tiff, let's come up. I guess we get to sit down or wander around. You all have the lapel mics, right? So I can stay here at the podium and you can just talk. So we'd be happy to entertain any questions. If everybody's kind of hungry, I don't think you can go eat right this moment, but you could wander off. The food, I think, is going to be here at 12:30. I don't know if it's arrived already. What's that? You think it's out there? So if you're more hungry for food than knowledge, you could get the food right now. And come back.
Something came to mind as you were giving your talk about the translocating the vein up into here. I've thought about doing that, and I think in the future I probably will, if there's been patients, make me do that operation. You've done some of those.
Yeah.
I've had the experience, and we talked about last night, of doing axillary inflow, and I thought when I take this huge vein in these patients that are all difficult patients, I might configure that where I have an axillary inflow, flow of that vein into the vein reversed, and tie it in either to brachial or basilic or something down in the mid-arm, coming off the axillary artery that's 8, 9, 10 millimeters in diameter instead of a 3 or 4 millimeter brachial artery in that, with that huge outflow vein, I think is more likely. At least that's how I imagine me doing that operation.
And we came up with a name for that, right?
Yeah.
That was preemptive proximalization. Remember that. When we talk about steel later, we'll talk a little bit about proximalization to deal with those problems. And you're doing it before you get into the problem, thinking ahead, you know, might be a good approach, although it's not been tried a lot.
Right. One comment I had, we focused on the utility of the ultrasound as a tool. One problem is that there really aren't national standards into what represents good vessel mapping preoperatively. And I'd recommend going to the Fistula First website because there are forms and recommendations about the process of doing good vessel mapping preoperatively.
I think that's very important. We talked about working closely with your vascular lab and making sure they give you what you need to know. Two components of that. One is you have to know what it is you need to know, and then you have to do the communication steps. And a lot of the vascular societies have been looking at trying to have established criteria. And in my talk a little bit, I said there aren't, you know, what is the stenosis in one of these fistulas, particularly after you look at, there is not a set criteria for that. Society for Vascular Surgery has not published any. Society for Vascular Ultrasound does have some criteria that they've put forward. So yeah, there's a lot on the Fistula First website about it.
Yeah.
So a problem with the dialysis stuff is we have a good functioning fistula that I think it could be used and utilized, but still they end up with either perforation, going through, getting hematomas, and making the good fistula worse, and resulting in either jumping together side. What is your solution to that problem?
Well, what is evolving because of these cannulation difficulties is cannulation teams. If you go to a dialysis unit, the person to ask about who does the best cannulation of a fistula is the patients. Identify those people who have expertise with cannulation, certainly initially. Have an initial protocol, and those are available again at the website for cannulating a fistula. You want your best people doing it initially, and you want an initial protocol and follow that protocol. We talk about the baseball rule. Nobody goes to these dialysis units wanting to do harm to their patients, but if there is an infiltration or they're having difficulty cannulating the fistula, we use the modified baseball rule. Two strikes and you're out. So if the first person tries to cannulate it and they can't get it, it's not that they don't want to, but they can't get it, the second person strikes out after two, stop. Stop trying to use that fistula. You're going to ruin it. Come back another day. Come back the next day. Put ice on it. You should have a protocol for that. I think a very good development is the large dialysis organizations are actually starting to design and implement these cannulation teams, and we're fortunate enough to have Janet Holland in the background here, and she might want to comment about how one of the large companies is is developing cannulation teams and approaches so that we don't have these errors and ruin all your good hard work.
Yeah, I think if you go to the Fistula First website, and we talk about the program being a comprehensive program, all those change concepts, and we're focusing on surgery and intervention and stuff like that, there are components that are directed to facilities and to personnel and to patients to educate them and techniques that can help with this kind of problem. And it is a nationwide problem. There's a tremendous turnover in staff in dialysis facilities. It's very difficult for even the best facility managers and the LDOs to retain their best people, and identifying experts at each facility to initiate these cannulations is a very important step.
Yes. Yeah, does the panel have any experience or thoughts on using cryopreserved veins for making fistulas in difficult patients?
My experience has all been bad. It's basically dead vein. And, those of you who might be old, like Tip, might have used something like a bovine heterograft, which is, dead collagen. So they'll work for a while, but they'll scar up and fail and become aneurysmal and all of that. I think somewhere along the line I talk about drills later on today, and one of the papers about drills, talked about using cryovein for the drill, and they all failed. So I think in these kind of applications, they're not reliable. That's what I hear.
I had a quick question, but we've put in a lot of cryovanes, and we found that when we studied them, we found that their patency was very similar to PTFE.
Right.
The only advantage is they resist infection more. That's about it. Otherwise, you're dealing with them the same way, just as you guys said. I had a quick comment and a couple short questions. A comment was, one, I didn't hear any emphasis on preoperatively examining for central vein stenosis. And I think that's a very important part. If they're pre-dialysis, we even do a CO2 venogram if we're concerned at all, to look for any stenosis, because you can get burned, and they may not work if collateralization is not good enough. Questions, first, that software you showed earlier, is that available?
Yes, it's commercially available.
Because okay. You didn't put a name on it or anything, or how we could find it.
It's Renesan, R-E-N-E-S-A-N. You Google it. There are a lot of other products out there, so I'm certainly not supporting just this one.
No, I just wanted.
In terms of the previous issue, I'll talk a little bit about imaging, preoperative imaging for central vein stenosis in the swollen arm talk this afternoon.
Okay. Well, I just think that's kind of important, preoperative. But
you want to talk about that?
I think it is, too. I think there's two components to it. One is that with ultrasound, it's often difficult to assess whether there's a stenosis until you power up that arm and increase the flow through the veins. So ultrasound can be misleading.
Absolutely.
A lot of people are reluctant to give contrast, and CO2 is a good option. The other component of it is I think that many patients with central venous stenosis can have successful fistulas in those arms. Not all. Many. And so I think you have to strike a balance between how much you want to know and how much you need to know. And I'd be interested in Dr. Jennings' views about that.
We kind of had a little chat last night about this topic, and I'm starting to keep track of those that I do with that scenario. I see a lot of people that have had a million catheters, and they've got scars on both arms, and they've got a little brachial vein that I can imagine transposing. I don't have one of those pictures in my talk, but I've got several examples, and I think at some point I'll put those together. But my take on that is we do a central venogram if they've had a lot of catheters or if we see the big dilated veins, and Dr. Work's going to talk about swollen arm. But this is a preemptive question. What do you do about those patients that you suspect might? And generally, they're people already on dialysis because the reason they've got that problem is they've had so many catheters. So we get a central imaging, and if they have, and many of them will, a lot of collaterals, I can construct a little limited flow fistula coming off the radial artery, maybe a brachial vein or radial vein fistula that maybe is a 400, 500 flow fistula. And if they have a lot of collaterals going into that, my experience is they almost never have arm swelling or not enough to make it a problem. So most of those patients, you can pick by adding that other information which ones are going to be successful, even with a completely occluded central channel. And if we see it's just stenotic, man, we don't hesitate to make the fistula because we're going to deal with that.
I agree. It's the completely occluded.
Right, but even if it is, if there's a lot of collaterals, you can pick those out.
And particularly a relatively low-flow forearm fistula works very, very well even with complete central occlusion.
Right.
And the other component is you can't tell if you're going to have a problem until you make the fistula.
Correct.
I'm not aware of any either radiographic or ultrasound criteria that could definitively tell you you're going to get into trouble with swelling.
Well,
with this particular arrangement.
One side's occluded and the other's not. You're going to go to that side. My last question. You listed the criteria for success, and that's a 300 cc's a minute flow on the dialysis machine. I mean, not access flow, but dialysis machine flow. If I make a fistula and it's 300 to 350, that's sent back to me. That's inadequate from my nephrologist. They want 450 flow. I could increase my success rate if they would accept lower flows. And we've had discussions about that, and you know, they debate among themselves whether they're going to accept lower flows or not. So because a 300 fistula is not adequate for them, that gets sent back to me to do something different. So I don't know if you guys have to deal with that at all or not.
If they sent that back with a message that we would like a sack of gold bullion, would you then deal? So there are times where you're going to negotiate with a nephrologist. And let me give you an example. An 80-pound lady that is about 4 feet 10 inches tall, she probably doesn't need to dialyze to be successful at 700 milliliters a minute. So there's always room for negotiation.
Yeah, we argue, but...
Well, a lot of this is a differentiation between certain geographic areas. I mean, you look at the DOPS data, and a lot of people criticize that because they tend not to dialyze as hard in Europe. They don't use the same kind of high flows that the American dialysis centers tend to use. And so there is flexibility in getting that prescription in the patient. And, you know, Jack, you may want to comment on it.
There are a number of strategies that are evolving in this country. Certainly in Japan, they put a fistula in and use it 2 weeks later. It's not unusual. But they're using low flow and longer dialysis times. Another strategy that is evolving here with some very good outcomes is nocturnal in-center dialysis. So that's three times... per week, larger patients, they're dialyzing 8 hours at a time in center overnight at lower flows with these marginal fistulas that don't give you that liter per minute flow. And these patients actually, because they have more hours per week, are doing a lot better, phosphorus control is better, and they're feeling better. So there are other strategies ones can
yeah, we do
can
that. Use. Perhaps I'll suggest maybe that's where the low-flow fistulas go. But thank you.
When would you do grafts then? You said, Dr. Jennings, that in 100% of cases you've done fistulas in the last couple of years. Because I have a patient, and I'd like to know how you would handle this. 15-year-old kid, failed his first transplant from recurrent focal sclerosis. He's also hypercoagulable, has a central vein occlusion, subclavian syndrome, has had bilateral femoral grafts that got infected, and he's on PD. They need access because we know that when we retransplant him, he's going to have recurrence of his focal sclerosis, and we need to lower his antibody anyway now because he's highly sensitized.
Okay, I'll accept that challenge. And I mean, you've already started. You've said some things I'd have to know more about. People talk about hypercoagulable patients. So you need to tell me that he's got a protein C or a protein S. If you mean he's got a little elevation of his factor 8 or a little homocysteine elevation, they all have that.
Right.
And so that's not hypercoagulable. Now, you've already defined a patient that has a central venous occlusion. So if you study them and he's got a lot of collaterals up here, I'd make a little brachial or basilic transposition, let that mature, and think I can get away with that and be successful. Because we're already starting on a tremendously difficult case. The next thing you've said is that he had graft infections already. So do you want to put another graft in him?
Not really.
Thank you. So he's got an open vena cava inferiorly, and he's got two femoral veins. That is Wayne Gradman, who has written the biggest series about pediatric access. diffuse femoral vein fistulas on these kids, you're gonna not have the peripheral vascular component that led to so much trouble. So to me, it sounds like you're describing a patient that you're going to use his femoral vein if you're not able to do a low flow fistula successfully because of collateral.
But what about the fact that we don't know, you know, this child's longevity, and you know, as time goes on, if you do a femoral vein, will you have problems 10 years, 15 years down the line?
I'm going to challenge you on this because you've constructed a case that's so complex and so difficult, and then you said, gosh, tell me what to do.
Right.
And so then I did, and then you said, okay, well, what happens 10 years from now? I think that we're getting to the point that it's not fair. So I think I gave you a very fair answer, and then after I respond to this next one, you're going to say, okay, well, what if an asteroid hits?
And the other
question is, so I
think
that's enough of that case.
The other question is, why not do more PD? And I think that's one of the choices that we should be doing.
There's a lot of smart people here and a lot of great questions, and I've dodged some of them. I've got slides on that. And here's the guy that's got the great phrase, and I'm going to go ahead and say it. Dr. Work, I can't remember when I first heard him say this, why not use the good catheter? And so, I stole your line. I can't help it. It's such a great line. There is a good catheter in this world, and about 15% of American people use it. I think it's 15%. And it's peritoneal dialysis. And it works great. What a wonderful central venous catheter reduction strategy. When we had 60 or 70% grafts in arms, with great big huge veins coming up here, a super central venous catheter reduction strategy was once they start failing, turn them into fistulas that can be used the next day. Now, we don't have as many grafts, but we've got a lot of people that have catheters, put them on PD, and that adds time to your consultation when you're talking to the patient because they say, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. And you need to send them to the PD nurses whose training is to convince them they can do that.
It's actually the nephrologists, I find, that tell me that they can't do PD on these patients because they don't think the patients are adequately intelligent, I guess, especially in the Bronx.
Then you need to educate them.
I had some slides on that this afternoon.
If you look at the statistics from the USRD, it is clear that the raw number of patients being treated with PD has not increased over 10 years. It's about 25,000. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the number of patients in end-stage renal disease being treated is doubled.
But theoretically, that should change now that they changed, that there's an incentive to do PD.
Let's hope.
That's correct.
Okay.
Quick scenario. Patient with a brachiocephalic vein in the right arm. The internal jugular is open. Subclavian veins occluded. The left arm's been used multiple times. Patient now has venous hypertension in arm. Hero catheters, I've never used one. You could tunnel it into the internal jugular. Would you take that vein out of that arm and translocate it into the opposite arm?
Here's a talk on swollen arms.
Well, we'll talk about the HERO device this afternoon, but you indicated that you wanted to take that vein, put it over in the other arm, and the other arm must be okay. Why not construct something over there?
It's already been used. So it does not have veins. The largest vein I can find is a 2-millimeter vein, but it's got an axillary vein. So take the cephalic vein out of this arm, translocate it here, plug into your axillary vein as your outflow.
It works.
Or would you use a HERO catheter and tunnel into the internal jugular?
Well, we'll talk more about the HERO catheter. I think it's a very good device for a very highly selected group of patients, and those patients who are catheter dependent. And as you're describing, there are no other options in either in any of the extremities, including the thighs. Then it's a useful device if the patient is not hypotensive. A lot of the problem is that these patients tend to have cardiomyopathies and struggle to have a systolic pressure of 100 while on dialysis. And in that setting, the HERO device doesn't work very well because it thromboses off repetitively. But if the patient has good blood pressure and everything else is exhausted, then the HERO device is a good option. But it's that highly selected group of patients.
I've got to make a comment. I have another choice. And everybody understand the case that just got presented. You've got a swollen arm. You have an open fistula that's still there, a swollen arm, and a brachiocephalic fistula, right?
Right.
Jack's?
The other option, what is the flow in this fistula is the question. If the flow is 2,000 or 1,500 mils, reduce the flow, and oftentimes the symptoms go away and the fistula stays open.
So I've done 15 or 20 of these, and we've about finished a paper together with Dr. Miller. People are familiar with Miller banding. And actually, so in your patient, what we would do when there's no other options, 95% of the time, my good colleague can put sneak a guide wire through here, angioplasty, maybe stent, maybe not, and make that arm okay. In those cases we can't, you can salvage, I think you can salvage that patient in either the cath lab or in the OR, a little small incision, you get the fistula out, you put a four balloon down through there right close to the anastomosis, and you band that down with a precision banding technique to a 4 millimeter, you drop the pressure, and we're going to report the pressure drop and the flow drop and the salvage of those pressures and with resolution in those patients of their symptoms. So
in one of our talks this afternoon, I've got some pictures to show you how to do that, and there's a lot of good literature references on it.
Yeah, so that would be how I'd handle that.
Could you go through your decision-making tree in terms of when you would use a translocated vein versus a synthetic graft?
I think the decision about a translocated vein really depends on who the patient is. And, we have some fit patients in every other respect who have end-stage renal disease who can go through a big operation and end up with a lifelong fistula that they can use. And then we have a lot of wrecks. And so I think there's a real role for judgment and experience in getting people through big operations. If your practice is a general kind of vascular practice where you deal with a bunch of older folks and you're making these kind of decisions all the time, that's pretty easy. If you have a real focused fistula practice, you may not see a lot of this decision-making stuff, but I think it's all the assessment of what the patient can withstand. I think if you can get a good upper arm access with autogenous using a translocated, I think that's the most optimal solution. It's not something for everybody. The elderly, patients who have a limited life expectancy, high comorbidities, I think that's probably a little much for them.
We heard a wonderful talk from somebody who gets virtually 100% success rate with autogenous vein fistulas. Earlier, we saw lots of references to a high percentage of vein fistulas that never matured and references to a prognostic scoring system that would have a predictive value of fistulas that wouldn't be usable or mature. With the suggestion that if you had 50% or 70% or whatever the score was, you shouldn't choose to do a vein fistula in that patient. I wonder if the panel could comment on that, and what is an acceptable failure rate or a rate of choosing not to do a autogenous fistula based on such a prognostic scoring system?
Start, Jack.
You've misinterpreted the risk stratification tool. It's really a tool to identify those patients who are at higher risk. I think the point is that you really want to look at each patient individually and look at their own and make those decisions based on that individual patient. So you may have the elderly patient who is likely to live quite a while and has acceptable veins. And in that situation, by all means, evaluate that for a patient for a fistula and create the fistula. The thing is, it's judgment on an individual basis. So if that patient that you think has a good chance of having a mature fistula, even though their score is above 7, but they have 3 millimeter veins on vascular mapping, they're physiologically likely to live longer, go ahead and put a fistula in. But again, the judgment. See them back in 2 weeks for the follow-up that Dr. Jennings described. See them back for sure in 3 to 4 weeks to see if that fistula is indeed maturing. If it is not, there's usually a reason, and it's most likely correctable by interventional means. What is extraordinary about the endovascular intervention is if they have that juxta-anastomotic lesion and you correct it, usually within 1 to 2 weeks, that fistula is ready to use. It happens that quickly. So by all means, do that. But on the other hand, if that fistula is not maturing, you've done the interventions, and that patient now has 4 or 5 months worth of catheter time, make the decision that, hey, you've tried, it isn't working, let's get that catheter out, because it's the balance act between the lethal weapon of the catheter and getting that patient the best access possible. So it's a, each patient has to be judged individually.
If I remember your slide, one of the scores was a 70% failure rate at a certain level. Are you suggesting that
that's a tool to help guide you to make the, help making the decision in cooperation with the nephrologist and the patient? It's not an absolute by any means.
And that refers, you know, I think in all fairness, that's a good question. That refers to that single practice, right? That single institution and their outcomes.
As a practicing surgeon, it's sometimes difficult to tell a patient you're going to do an operation with a 70% failure rate. Patients, and they don't like to come back.
I don't think you should do an operation with a 70% failure rate. So if you can judge your own capabilities and judge the vein, I think that's not beyond what I would ask myself is to, if I can find a vein that's 4 millimeters in diameter and it's going to have enough length, and I can imagine that I'm going to, by looking with the ultrasound, imagine I'm going to be able to put that vein down to the artery in a manner that's not tight and with the details that I think are going to be successful, I wouldn't go into an operation thinking I'm going to have a 70% failure rate, or I'd have a different strategy. So if that's what it works out, then you ought to put a graft in that patient. But I'm trying to say, I think that you, listening to all these different things, we're suggesting that you can have a high percentage of fistulas. That doesn't mean you're going to have 100% of fistulas. So I think we're dancing around numbers a little bit.
I think the other component of it is you look at that risk score for maturation. Most of the factors in there are patient factors and not vein factors or anything else. And I have a lot of problem with an a priori scheme that's just a bunch of numbers on a piece of paper that writes off a patient's opportunity to have an access that can last the rest of their life. I think this is a real role for doctors doing doctoring, using judgment, using experience, using the knowledge that you expand, you know, by coming to a session like this and making the right judgment for your patients. Sometimes that right judgment is going to be, I'm going to use a graft. But I think if you don't look and you don't think and you don't consider and bring all these things we learned today to bear, you're going to do a disservice to your patients. That's my view on it.
Are there any downsides to the buttonhole technique? I'm getting pushback from some of my nephrologists citing recent reports that there may in fact be disadvantages. I'd be interested in hearing your comments.
This is my perspective and should be taken as such. I think the buttonhole technique is ideal for patient self-cannulation if at all possible. If the patient is willing to do it, I'd recommend MediSystems that makes needles has an excellent DVD that's available that talks about the buttonhole technique. The important part of the buttonhole technique, no matter who is doing it, is the process. So you need to know how to clean the arm initially, know how to sterilely or carefully remove the scab. You don't take the dialysis needle that you're going to use for cannulation and pull off the scab. There's actually MediSystems and other needle makers makes a little tool, or you can take sterile forceps and remove the scab. And most importantly, then you have to follow up with a second cleansing of the arm. Then you'll reduce the risk of infection greatly. Again, you get the muscle memory, if you will, of going through the same scar tract into the vein. You, after about 6 to 9 times, that scar tract is formed, and you can go over to the non-cutting buttonhole needle. But if you have multiple cannulators trying to go through the same external exit site with needles, they oftentimes will create a dome-like structure, an aneurysmal structure over the vein. And again, ideally, you have the same cannulator each and every time. If that's not possible, oftentimes you can have 2 sets of buttonholes so that one person uses their set and then the next person uses their own set. So you have that muscle memory of going through the same track each and every time. Where you get into trouble with it is if you don't follow the rigorous process of getting the scab off and cleansing the area of the buttonhole, and you get every Tom, Dick, and Harry that's there in the dialysis unit trying to go through it. That's where you get into problems. But if you have a specialized cannulation team of one or two or maybe even three people doing the cannulation, then it's a wonderful process.
Howdy, Ben Pierce. I'm from San Antonio, Texas, and the proportion of diabetic patients with arm disease is very high. I know you're going to talk about steel later, but in looking at your talk about constructing proximal radial artery fistulas, we anecdotally see a large number of patients who are either radial artery dominant, codependent, or have non-compressible distal vessels. Do you avoid the proximal radial artery in the patients who have either a codependent or a radial dominant hand?
So here's a question about a patient that maybe the radial artery, and I think it's few patients that are radial artery dominant. But you can detect clinically if they have an ulnar occlusion, and or if the really rare case where the radial artery is the big artery and the ulnar is a little thread. I've done, in those few cases, I'll come off the origin of the ulnar artery. So there is room in all these talks for using common sense. So if you present me a case, which you've just done, in a person with at risk for steal, peripheral vascular disease, and you flipped my usual findings, you flipped that upside down and said, well, now it's not the great big ulnar artery that's open, it's the other way around, man, I'll come off the ulnar artery.
Yeah, I guess I think that, and I apologize, we haven't put these numbers together, but it's something for us to do with our residents. I think a lot of these patients that have diabetes have disease, distal disease, in both arteries. And so on the ultrasound, when they do the Allen's test, they're showing up as having either radial dominant or codependent, or there's some flow abnormality distally in the arm that, you know, all you see is a calcified vessel when you look with the ultrasound, but the actual flow characteristics are altered. And so does going off a bigger artery like the brachial and constructing a smaller anastomosis make more sense? Or do you trust that preoperative Allen's test and say, I'm going to go off the ulnar? Because the anatomic appearance of the radial dominant still doesn't necessarily look that much larger. I mean, it's the exact same kind of what you show, which is it's big in the proximal segment, there's the branch, and then it gets smaller, even though that's the dominant flow vessel. And I think it has to do with the distal disease in the patient. So maybe, I guess, and I understand what you're saying, and I'm not trying to question you like what you, with the other gentleman earlier, you were giving him.
I've been questioned before, and I'll be questioned again.
But the artery also tends to be softer and more sewable. So those patients I've taken to actually transposing the cephalic into the brachial above the intercubital fossa, because I feel like that it's I can get a smaller anastomosis compared to the size of the artery, and it's softer there. Is that is that what you would do, or you really think that you would still try to go?
Well, you know, I think these are the patients where the more proximal brachial anastomosis produces the steel. And I think making a little tiny anastomosis up there can be a little tricky. I don't find that easy. When you have a patient that your ultrasound evaluation and your clinical evaluation suggest you're getting into some significant arterial disease, I think you need more information. So in those patients, I get an arteriogram.
Mm-hmm.
I don't fool around. And if they've got disease that needs to be treated, I treat it. If the ulnar is kind of puny or maybe has a couple of stenoses in it, treat them.
Well, and I can tell you what that arteriogram shows. It shows both arteries to the hand severely diseased into the hand. That's the problem. I mean, mm-hmm. these patients...
Well, in some of these cases, the only real answer for that is going to be a real proximal loop type
axillary.
Access. Mm-hmm. Axillary loop or preemptive strike with
a primary axillary inflow. I'm going to show you a couple pictures of things that I might do in critical situations. So here in the questioner has presented us with a challenging case, a difficult case, and as the presentation goes on, the case gets worse and worse, and we've got a severe person.
Well, but these aren't cases. These are real patients.
Oh, I know.
The diabetic patients have, it's just like with their legs. I mean, they have very diseased forearm vessels, and so I'm not saying that. Well, you know, come help me out. I'm asking for your opinion.
Let me respond.
Yeah.
All right. So we're presented with a severe peripheral vascular disease, both vessels, right?
Right.
Severe peripheral vascular disease. That patient's at risk for steel syndrome. I would for sure take issue and not agree with your idea that you were putting forward about coming off the brachial artery.
Okay.
I think that's I would not do that. And it may be that you can convince yourself that you could come off either the origin of the radial or the origin of the ulnar, leaving the better vessel into the hand. It may be that both of those vessels terminate and you believe that you have a 3.5 millimeter brachial artery and you're at great risk for steal. I'm going to present you and show you some pictures at the very end of my last talk where I would have inflow from the axillary artery as a preemptive strike to avoid the steel risk.
Well, that's,
but not the brachial artery. I do not agree with coming off the brachial artery in that patient. I think that's a mistake.
That's great. Asking for trouble.
Thanks.